And when the list of authors came out, they wanted us, you know, to submit little bios and pictures about ourselves. That's when I realized I was one of the youngest and probably the only women on the list of the developers. So that was pretty exciting for me. And I love the limitless space for imagination. I was really honored when all my contributions to open source by the Red Hat Women in Open Source Academic Award I got. And that's exactly where I contribute open source to introducing me to the world of machine learning.
Welcome to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast, where Justin Grammans and the team at Emerging Technologies North talk with experts in the fields of artificial intelligence and deep learning. In each episode, we cut through the hype and dive into how these technologies are being applied to real-world problems today. We hope that you find this episode educational and applicable to your industry and connect with us to learn more about our organization at appliedai.mn. Enjoy.
Welcome, everyone, to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. Today, we're talking with Jigyasa Grover. Jigyasa recently co-authored a book titled Sculpting Data for ML, The First Act of Machine Learning. The book is a culmination of her myriad of experiences from brief stints at Facebook, National Research Council of Canada, and Institute of Research and Development, France, involving data science, mathematical modeling, and software engineering. She graduated from the University of California, San Diego, with a master's degree in computer science and an artificial intelligence specialization. Jigyasa is presently applying her past experiences and knowledge towards applied machine learning in the online advertisement prediction and ranking domain. I love this part of her bio. She served as the director of Women Who Code and lead of Women Tech Makers for a handful of years to help bridge the gender gap in technology. In her quest to build a powerful community of girls and boys alike and believing in we rise by lifting others, she mentors aspiring developers and machine learning enthusiasts in various global programs. Thank you, Jigyasa, for all that you do to help the next generation of machine learning engineers. And I'm really, really excited to have you on the program today.
Thank you so much, Justin, for having me. And I'm pretty excited as well.
I gave a brief intro with regards to, you know, some of the places that you've worked leading up to where you are today. I mean, I'm just wondering if you maybe could elaborate, give us a little bit more detail on what the trajectory of your career was, you know, from coming out of school to writing a book to sort of what you're doing today here.
For that, I'll have to like hit rewind a bit. And we go back to the year 2013 and 2014. I had just started out my undergraduate degree. And I was just kind of like curious as to what I want to do in my career and what I do want to do in my life in general. And that's where I came across open source and contributing to open source. So since 2014, I've been like actively working in this multinational collaborative environment, you know, adapting to variances in cultures, time zones, working styles, because being in a completely different location, and I was just like an icon on the screen when I used to work in open source back then. There was very little video conferencing going on. It was mostly like internet relay chat and so on. That is what attracted me to open source the most, like the creative independence it gave me to work on projects of my own choice, to work from anywhere and not revealing my full identity, because let's be honest, I did have kind of like an imposter syndrome there. So I was working on a project called Faro. And as I said, I was just like an icon on the screen. I used to interact with mentors from China, Singapore, France. And they were also writing like a book on the side. It was kind of like a community fed book, which was Faro 5.0. And when the list of authors came out, they wanted us, you know, to submit little bios and pictures about ourselves. That's when I realized I was one of the youngest and probably the only women on the list of the developers and stuff. So that was pretty exciting for me. And I loved, you know, the limitless space for imagination and stuff. I was appreciated internationally by the Red Hat Women in Open Source Academic Award I got. And that's exactly where I contribute open source to introducing me to the world of machine learning. Because as I was working on like a project called Suzy, which was aimed at building a virtual digital assistant in open source with developers from FOSS Asia, which is an open source community, during my participation as a Google Summer of Code student. That's where I, you know, came to know about natural language processing, machine learning, and so on. I started taking up classes in school and pursuing my interest in this field, I applied for, you know, a specialized degree, as you mentioned that I did graduate from University of California, San Diego with a master's degree in a similar domain. And that's where my trajectory from open source, you know, building web apps, Android apps, turned to like a machine learning kind of specialization. At present, here I am applying my experiences and knowledge towards online ad prediction and ranking at Twitter.
Okay, awesome. You were talking about open source, and you know, I'm a huge proponent of open source. I mean, I've been using it for pretty much my entire career. The Apache Foundation is just, you know, amazing. But even companies like Red Hat, they do some great things by giving back to the Linux Foundation and the Linux community. And one of the things I think is really cool about software engineering is people can speak any language, but yet the code is universal, right? People are committing code and everybody knows how to write code, but they may not even be able to speak to each other.
Absolutely. Like, that's what I said. Like, my time zone was completely off. I used to send a message and, you know, because I was based in India back then. And then I was speaking a completely different language. One of my first mentors was from China. And the only thing kind of we understood in common was like the code that we shared with each other. So definitely it was a learning experience. And I was so glad because it gave me like a sense of achievement that I was doing something other than the coursework that I used to do during undergrad study.
Understood, for sure. You mentioned the Google Summer of Code. How did you get into that? I'm curious.
When I was talking to my mentors from the FARUP community that I talked about, they said they were working on a project which was associated with FOSS Asia, the open source community, and they were applying for, you know, being a mentorship program for Google Summer of Code. Why don't you apply as a student? So I kind of like wrote a big application. It was mostly like a project proposal. That was also my first time writing a project proposal. I learned a lot, you know, like what are the requirements? You have to have like a timeline ready, deliverables, and so on. So that's how I got in the first time. And I was working on like a search utility written in Smalltalk, which is, again, one of the very different languages people don't use. But for me, it was a great exposure to, you know, object-oriented languages. The next year, as I said, I started working on Suzy, which is kind of like the virtual digital assistant. So the next year, I was kind of like experienced and then applied and I got in again. So I was like pretty excited, you know, two times in a row. And I thought like, why not give it a shot like third time? But then by then, Google had changed its rules that you cannot apply to the same program, you know, more than twice because they wanted to give everyone kind of like equal opportunities, which I totally understood. But I still wanted to be involved in the community. And that's when I applied to be a mentor. I mentored young students or like enthusiasts who were applying for these programs for the first time. And thereon, I also ended up becoming an organization administrator for FARO. So initially, as I said, FARO was associated with FOSS Asia. But then we kind of like made FARO its own organization. And we were quite proud because 50% of our participants were like females from developing nations. And that's what we kind of like aim to have, like diverse people from different backgrounds. As I said, like the universal language was code to have in that program.
And how would you find the females in these developing countries? Do you have satellite groups that meet there?
So some of our members were kind of like professors as well. And they used to, you know, communicate with other professors in these universities and spread the word, you know, via the mailing list in their own universities, asking people to participate and submit like a project proposal.
Gotcha. Yeah, really, really cool. No, I love that idea of just giving back and getting more and more women into the field. One of the things that I like to ask people is, how do you define artificial intelligence or machine learning? If you're on an elevator and somebody says, what do you do? You know, how do you use this AI, ML stuff? Do you have a short description, I guess?
So in my mind, I always try to think of AI as kind of like exploring the depth of what we have as like human intelligence. And then we try to pass on our abilities to the machines so that, you know, they can replace and mimic human intelligence, so that we empower machines to solve like complex problems with minimal or no human intervention at all.
I see.
So it's kind of like a circle. You explore your own intelligence and you also pass it on to the machine.
I see. Yes, so you're passing it on to the machine then that can learn but it's always going to need some additional intelligence being fed to it as well, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. The other question I like to ask people is like, so what does a day in the life look for somebody that's in your position, you know, as people get into this career?
Since 2020, of course, everything's gone remote. I try to work from home as diligently as possible and, you know, have routine. But one thing that I have is like always have my to-do ready. To give you an insight into what a to-do list of a machine learning engineer would look like, it includes like, you know, digging up into some data, finding some trends, setting up experiments, which takes up like the larger part of my day is like machine learning experiments, you know, with tweaking different features, tweaking the model architecture, and then brainstorming with stakeholders, which include product managers, data engineers, data scientists, as I said, engineering a new feature, thinking about it, and then analyzing model performance. And the major part is tying the model metrics to product metrics, because that's a huge point. You cannot always have like, oh, the model performs like 98% accurately, or like, you know, that's the recall is done. Something, but that should also translate into improvement in your business metrics, especially if you're working in a company that, or in a product that kind of like brings in revenue. For example, ads prediction and ads ranking definitely bring in revenue for Twitter. So that is something that we have to keep in mind. And that is one of the major aspects.
Interesting. I'm assuming there's a lot of data cleaning that needs to happen. And I'm kind of, you know, setting up maybe the discussion to talk a little bit about your book, Sculpting Data for ML. What are some of the things that you're working on in that space? And maybe a little bit of a highlight of what the book talks about.
Sure. So data definitely forms the biggest and the strongest foundation of a machine learning model. Many a times we've seen that we, even if we apply like sophisticated algorithms, or we have like, you know, high computation powers and resources, sometimes not just having access to the right data points, you know, which could, you know, connect it to the label that we have or to the output that we want, is the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome. And that's where, you know, having the right sort of data and, you know, transforming it the right way to have the features that we need in terms of providing the essential data signal to a model comes in really handy. And this is exactly what has been, you know, one of the biggest and the most popular campaigns going on in the AI and ML community these days, is like taking the data-centric approach to machine learning. For so long, we've always focused on the code-centric aspect, as in like, how can we make our model more sophisticated? How can we add a new layer, you know? Or just simply like, how can we add more resources? How can we parallelize the efforts? But really has been the focus been on like the kind of data we are feeding, like how are we transforming it? How are we creating new features out of it? And that is exactly what I found during my grad school studies as well. Like when I wanted to work on any novel problem, let's say I have some idea in mind. Sometimes there was no data set, or sometimes there was a data set which I might not be happy with. So we kind of like tried to Google search and, you know, find blogs and stuff like that. But rarely did we come across kind of like a platform which was all inclusive, like told you, like, here's how you curate your own data set. Here's how you source the data. Here's how you process it. Here's how you create features and then input into the model. Like most of the blogs or stuff or books that you would read would, you know, start from, here's your data, let's start how we can input into the model and like how we can fine tune the hyperparameters and so on. So we wanted something, you know, which was like, goes way beyond like input to the model. Like input to the model, we thought of it as the end product and start from like before.
I see. So yeah, I love that, the sculpting aspect of the data. What are some of the challenges then for the data that you're working on a day-to-day basis, say at Twitter? I don't know specifically, are you working on ads that show up while I'm looking at Twitter? Are you looking for, you know, hey, you like this person, you might want to follow this person? You know, what are some of the things that you're working on?
So particularly for my team, I work on the promoted tweets or the sponsored content that you might see once in a while on your feed or like other display locations, like if you're on someone's profile and you come across like embedded in their tweets, one of the sponsored tweets that shows up.
Yeah, so that all that real quick decision making that needs to happen when somebody's looking at a Twitter feed. Yeah, it's got to be very fun working on a platform of that scale, right? The millions of people that are browsing Twitter.
That's true. But then with these security and privacy standards coming up, you know, with Apple's app tracking transparency and the GDPR rules, we have to be very mindful of the kind of data that we end up using. So that also becomes one of the biggest obstacles that we have.
Interesting. You mentioned about data and, you know, no one's taking this data-centric approach, which I think you're totally right. Everyone's talking about the parameters are tuned. We need to throw more GPUs at this, all that sort of stuff. This opened up in my mind the idea of sort of biased, you know, data. There's this sort of this whole idea around we're learning with biased data. So now our models are becoming more and more biased. You talk about that a little bit in your book, or have you seen that in your professional career?
So I do have seen it in my professional career and personal projects as well. But specifically, we believe that bias in data in itself is such a huge topic that we wanted to keep it more elementary. And we do touch the topic, but we don't go in depth. We do talk about, you know, how to have like exploratory data analysis to, you know, check for biases and stuff. But biases in itself can be of, you know, 100 different types based on the kind of data that you have. So probably, you know, we can work on this next, or like something that definitely needs to come up.
Are you thinking about a follow-up book then? I mean, has it been a lot of work maybe?
Let's see how that goes for sure. As I said, I'm always looking for my next big thing to do. I'm very like task-oriented in that form. So I need to have like a goal in mind, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one of the areas that I am really getting into now is tiny machine learning, tiny ML. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to the Tiny ML Summit here this next week.
Interesting.
And the one thing I think is really cool about Tiny ML is, you know, you can get sensor data just really quickly from the physical world. Mm-hmm. And allowing people to literally hook up a sensor, you know, maybe that's an accelerometer, and be able to just sort of move their hands around, and all of a sudden, boom, they've got tons and tons of data that they can start working with. So that's sort of a quick way to get a lot of data. Do you, I mean, in your book and maybe through what you're working on right now, as you guys are taking a data-centric approach, are you looking for ways to have people generate their own data, how they would generate more data to help sculpt, or is it still a lot of open data sets that are out there that can be mined, you think, today?
In our book specifically, we talk about, you know, web as a source of data, you know, like different websites that you might have. For example, one of the data set that we talked about is how you can have The Onion, which is kind of like a sarcastic website that you have, and then Huffington Post, which, you know, reports real news. How you can combine these two websites and data from these to create a data set, let's say, which has article headline, the article text, and if it's sarcastic or not, like as a label. And then you could use that data set to not only detect, like given a piece of, let's say, text, you can tell if it's sarcastic or not. Or perhaps you could use that data set to see, oh, if that was written from, like, which source did it belong to, like similar to that aspect. Or you can even have like articles from Huffington Post with their tags, and given a text snippet, you can find out like, oh, is it like a fashion kind of like written in a crime way, or like, you know, does it relate to fashion and so on. So these kind of like things that we discuss in the book is like considering web as like a limitless space for data.
Absolutely. No, that is a great thought. You're right. There's 1,000 websites being probably brand new websites being generated every minute. You know what I mean? And, and then even inside of that, obviously there's, I always forget the thing, but it's like just even in the past month, there's more new data that's generated on the internet than there was in the past 10 years, right? It's just, it's accelerating, just crazy. So yeah, just scraping over all that data gives you a lot of stuff that you can use. And I'm super excited because you're going to be presenting, I think, at one of our applied AI meetups in the coming months. So very excited to have our listeners be able to attend that and get a chance to learn more about the book. One of the other things is just trying to think about how artificial intelligence, I guess, will affect the future of work. I guess, you know, there are certain AIs that are being applied that some people say, oh, we'll no longer need a cancer doctor because, you know, they'll be able to read the x-rays better than anybody else. Are there any projects that you're seeing in the field that you think are interesting that are maybe a net positive to our future, to like a net negative? You know, I don't know, being in this space, maybe you're probably reading a lot and seeing what's going on. I always just sort of like to ask people that question.
Yeah, for sure. So definitely I've been thinking about this a lot. And I believe like the pandemic of 2020 drastically changed the scenario of remote collaboration we have. Social distancing, you know, forced majority of the world to work from home, utilizing video and audio calls to collaborate. And this kind of like workforce isolation has, you know, impacted creativity at all levels, you know, starting from junior developers who might be hesitant to reach out to mentors on text or something, you know, rather if you were in an office setting, to like, you know, C-suite executives. So that is exactly where I think leveraging metaverse could be a potential solution or to alleviate these shortcomings of remote collaboration, because humans are social beings. They like being around people. And if metaverse is kind of like promising to transcend those physical layers and provide like a sense of being there without being there, I really, really think that this would change the trends of remote work and, you know, the hybrid work systems that we have. And I'm quite excited for the future to learn about this, you know, quirky concept of this parallel universe where, you know, you're not no longer like an icon or like an avatar on the screen. You're mostly like a full-blown social personality in the metaverse and, you know, working in meta workspace despite physically not being there. So I'm quite excited about that aspect.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, you see yourself getting into maybe AR and VR in the future?
Yeah, probably. But I do need to do like a lot of groundwork, lot of fundamentals to be learned. But if given an opportunity, first of all, I'm like trying to work on the fundamentals and then, you know, move on to those aspects. But this is definitely quite an exciting thing to even think about, because no one would have thought, you know, like given like even 5 or 10 years ago, like who would have thought?
Yeah, for sure. And I love the aspect of the junior developers. As you were saying that, I was thinking about when I started my career, and it was back in the late 90s, and the internet was just really taking off and getting hot. It would be impossible for me to be sitting at home and learn just a fraction of what I, you know, learned just being in the office around people that had 5, 10 years ahead of me, and that I could just walk over to their desk and ask questions and bounce around stuff. So it's got to be really scary, I guess, for somebody maybe coming out of school trying to get themselves into a career today, not having that physical mentorship, right?
Yeah, totally. And also, I believe like there's so much that you can infer from someone's body language or their expressions that sometimes it's so difficult to write that out. Like you cannot always express your emotions, like how are you feeling, even in an office setting. For example, just like last week, I went in the office and I was like struggling for some things to work. And there was like a senior engineer sitting right next to me. I just like asked, and then he helped me, like didn't even take more than 2 minutes, you know, just to show me like how that works. And the exact same thing I had been, you know, trying to debug myself and thinking, you know, whom should I talk to? Like, whom should I message in the group or something? So definitely those things become a lot more easier when you're like physically in the same space.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other thing that's interesting is finding good engineers that live in your geographic region is difficult, you know? So I own a company, we're always trying to hire people. If you want everybody in the office, which I think is a perk, but it's not, you know, 100% needed. But if it's forced upon, you know, then you only have a small geographic region that you can find these people in. So it can be very, very limiting to a company that wants to grow and expand and bring in the best talent possible to be sort of stuck if they're requiring everybody to be in the office. So there's some benefits to be able to having like a remote workforce. I totally get it. But it's a fine line because, you know, the remote workforce, it's difficult for them to be junior engineers and yet still have them be productive or learn as quickly. So haven't solved that problem yet. I mean, are you're probably seeing that issue at Twitter, I'm guessing, or just about every company, I think, is finding it hard to hire somebody in the area that they're physically in.
That's true. And it's not even about hiring new people. Like, since the pandemic started, my team has gone in different areas of the country. Like, people have moved closer to their families, thinking like how the world almost a great spike in, you know, all these bad times that we had. So people wanted to be closer to family. Someone like wanted to buy a house and it was more affordable in the other state or something. So people definitely in my own team have moved to different parts of the country, even though before the pandemic, everyone used to be in the same geographic location. Definitely it's a struggle, and hoping like this meta workspace brings us all together despite not being physically together. So let's see how that goes.
Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of junior engineers and people that are just getting started, I mean, do you have any advice on things that as you look back on your career that and your path forward that you might suggest people, books they check out, conferences they go to, things they should do as they get into this field of AI and ML?
For AI and ML, I would definitely suggest, you know, having those fundamentals right, you know, learning about not just how to apply that model, but how that model actually works, how that algorithm works. So that is very important, because the coding aspect, it would definitely change from like which company you work for, which organization you work for, which project you're working for. You know, maybe someone would be using a different library to implement that. So implementation can definitely come, because the fundamentals are important. And on the other hand, I believe like anyone who is a machine learning engineer specifically also needs to have like good software engineering skills, because there's one thing to have like, you know, a model in your mind or like a model coded in, you know, your local notebook or something. But once you work for a bigger organization or a bigger project that you have to scale the service, definitely engineering skills come in handy. And regardless of good engineering skills, software engineering skills are very important. Whether you work for like backend engineering, mobile engineering, any kind of engineering, basically. Also, having mentors is really important. For me, I found my mentors when I was working in open source. And open source is another great place to start with machine learning if you need experience without having to, you know, intern at a place or like a kind of apply for internships, apply for full-time positions, apply for research scholarships and so on. Because there, you don't need any position to work on. You can just be any individual who contributes to open source project, yet gain experience. With that, you will be able to explore different domains to find which one you're passionate about. You can work on computer vision, natural language processing, and then figure out like which one did you like better. And those would be a few of my tips to, you know, someone who's getting started in the world of machine learning.
I love the open source aspect. I don't think I've heard that enough from most of the guests that I talk to that are on the podcast here is, you know, I view it as a great resume builder, right? So the moment anybody, you know, if I interview somebody for a position here at my company, the first thing I ask them is send me your GitHub repository. And then the second thing I'm looking for is have they contributed to any projects? And so going through and contributing, you know, it's one thing to build your own stuff. That's cool. But I do think you're right. It open source forces you to work on a team, forces you to be very transparent on your work, forces you to accept feedback, you know, change stuff with pull requests and all that stuff. So it's just like, I mean, somebody can point to a project to me and say, look, I worked on this and here's the other, you know, other developers that, you know, they can give me thumbs up for the work I did. It's just a great way to essentially prove yourself, right?
That's true. And you learn so much about, you know, the working style. Like when I was starting out with my first internship at a company, I realized I needed like very little assistance on like how to use Git. Because in my open source journey, I'd learned like, you know, one commit per pull request and every commit should be squashed into one, like every changes should be squashed into one commit and so on. So for me, like that workflow and that work style, you know, to maintain the repository very clean for the new contributors to come to, that also translates when you work in a professional setting.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Those skills, yeah, they're invaluable. You're right. No matter what company you go to, right? Mm-hmm. If you learn correct software development, processing, software engineering process, it's so valuable for sure. How do people reach out and connect with you? What's the best place for them to find you?
Twitter itself is the best place to find me. You can, so I'd be there at @Jigyasa_Grover. Also on LinkedIn, you can find me or feel free to message me any questions that you have and I'd be happy to help.
For each episode we do here, we have liner notes and I'll put not only, you know, link to your book and link to you, but then also just a number of these projects and stuff that you've talked about along the way. We'll find links to those on the internet. And so, yeah, people can read the entire transcript and be able to link off to all of this stuff. Well, is there any other topics or things that maybe you'd want to share about yourself that maybe I didn't touch on that you find interesting related to AI?
No, I guess you've touched most of the aspects.
Okay, girl, great. Well, cool, Jigyasa. Like I said, I'm really excited to have you present to our group. I'll put a link to our meetup as well in those notes. And again, being an author, I have a huge amount of respect for that. I have not yet written a book. I would love to write a book someday. It's sort of like on my bucket list of things to do. I know the amount of work and effort that goes into it. And I think it's really, really cool what you did. I think it's really, really cool what you're doing with regards to helping young girls and people getting into this profession. So I wish you nothing but the best and love to have you back on the program. Maybe in a year or so, we can sort of touch base and see how things are going on in the metaverse, right? Maybe you'll be doing something cool in that space.
That'll be so cool. Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm excited to talk to the community in an interactive way. And I'll be talking about different approaches to build a data set, the guided and the unguided search. So yeah, we'll meet each other next week.
You've listened to another episode of the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. We hope you are eager to learn more about applying artificial intelligence and deep learning within your organization. You can visit us at appliedai.mn to keep up to date on our events and connect with our amazing community. Please don't hesitate to reach out to Justin at appliedai.mn if you are interested in participating in a future episode. Thank you for listening.